Good afternoon. It is 12:02. Eric Scott here. Thank you for listening. And of course, being Friday, that means Jeb Bradley, state senator and Wolfboro resident, is our guest this morning. Senator, good morning.
Hey, Eric. Good morning.
How's
good afternoon
going?
Now, I think.
Yeah, it's actually afternoon. Everything going okay?
Everything's good.
Good, yeah. Heard you on Jack's show a little while ago. One of the first questions I wanted to ask you is about this. I realize that it's not really a state issue, but this whole impeachment thing, I don't get it. How can you impeach somebody from office when they're not in office?
Well, I think that's obviously a threshold question, you know, that's being raised in Washington. And look, I certainly from what I've heard and gleaned, and I'm pretty busy just, you know, dealing with the issues I'm dealing with in my part of the world. So I haven't, you know, been paying as much attention to national news as I otherwise might have been. But, you know, just hearing what I've heard, it seems the majority of legal scholars are of the opinion that this is not constitutional. And so obviously it's political. We know that. Everybody knows that. But whether it's constitutional to impeach somebody once they've left office is, I don't think there's an awful lot of support for the constitutionality of that.
And to be honest, it's academic. I mean, there are not enough votes in the Senate to convict him, period.
No, it would not appear that there are. And again, it comes back to it just being solely political, which here we are, today's the 12th.
Mm-hmm.
So as of Wednesday, President Biden will have been president for 4 weeks. And with the exception of all of his, you know, huge number of executive orders. You know, there's talk of a stimulus, but that's all it is. It hasn't happened. You know, so they're really eating into his, you know, early agenda items, it would seem to me, which from my point of view is not necessarily a bad thing, but it just seems to be rather stupid politically that, you know, Pelosi and Schumer are still so caught up in, you know, Donald Trump that they're undermining Joe Biden to go after Donald Trump.
I'll tell you, and I think I can speak for the majority of voters, we don't like revenge politics, and that seems to be... Now, I am no fan of the president. I have no love for him whatsoever. But on the other hand, this whole thing is a waste of time and money, in my opinion.
I mean, it's a waste of time and money in particular at a time that we're in a pandemic. We need to be focused on increasing the vaccine supply, making sure people are getting shots, getting schools open, which, you know, the Biden administration is falling apart on as far as I can see, you know, and wrestling with the economic repercussions of the pandemic. That should be, you know, topic 1 and 1A, the public health of the country and then reopening the economy and schools and, you know, other things that have been curtailed by the pandemic. And that's sort of getting lost in, you know, the rush to impeachment.
Sure. It's 12:06. We're talking with Jeb Bradley today, New Hampshire State Senator. One of the other sort of national questions I had was, you know, we hear the talk about this upcoming stimulus that may happen, say, next month or so, by the time they finish this stupid stuff down in Washington right now. What is it that I've heard that from the previous stimulus, there's money still unspent?
Oh, yeah, now, a lot of money still unspent.
Now, is there money in New Hampshire that hasn't been spent? And if so, why not?
States were under an obligation to account for all the money as of December 31st. So I don't know if there's unspent money that, you know, could have been held over past December 31st to deal with, you know, the still COVID-related health expenses. That's a possibility. But also remember that there was a second, you know, stimulus passed in late December where money probably is yet to flow to the state. So those are open questions.
Okay.
And, you know, it just, I think it begs the question of, I think most people in Washington would say that there is some level of ongoing need for dollars to make sure that the vaccine supply is getting, you know, produced as quickly as possible, which was happening, quite frankly, under President Trump. And I think, you know, the Biden administration is trying to do the same thing. So, you know, there's probably a need for that. There's probably a need for some ongoing help for, you know, people that are out of work, you know, whether it's through the unemployment system or direct checks. But remember, a lot of people got the, you know, they got checks in April and then again checks in December and January. Beyond that, you know, the public health and helping small businesses and individuals, I think, you know, there's a grab bag of things. And I'm not going to say New Hampshire should turn down any unencumbered funds that, you know, we could use in our budgeting process. But I think that the purpose of what Schumer and Pelosi are trying to do is to, you know, bail out states like California, Illinois, New York that have been poorly managed, not only, you know, with a pandemic crisis that all states have been affected by, but, you know, help them with past budget problems that they haven't dealt with. And that's where there's a lot of consternation, I think, about, you know, how much of these trillions of dollar charges on the nation's credit card are we going to do? You know, right now it's all fine, but eventually we're going to pay a price as, you know, there'll be inflationary pressure that'll increase, you know, costs on the borrowing of all this new money. What does that lead to? And, you know, I think people are starting to ask those questions. Certainly Larry Summers, who was, I think President Obama's Treasury Secretary, is warned of inflationary pressure. And I think that, you know, it's a very legit concern that doesn't seem to resonate in the mind of those who think just go big and throw money at problems.
It's funny. I was listening to a podcast the other day that the Federal Reserve has set an inflation target 2% annually a year, which I think we could probably all live with. But when, as you say, when you start stuffing all this money into the economy, what happens, you know, if it runs away? And we've had inflation before, those of you who remember the 70s.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it certainly remains to be seen if all the money that is, you know, flowing through the economy right now, which has been, you know, I think much of it has been necessary to prop up the economy from lost economic activity as a result of the pandemic, unquestionable. But, you know, you do have to ask how much more is necessary, how long is it going to go on, and is it, you know, is it going to lead to unintended consequences down the road? And then you start to see, you know, the pressures that a couple of the Biden administration's policies are going to have on prices. I mean, the price of gasoline is up about, you know, 20 cents to maybe even a little bit more a gallon since Keystone Pipeline was canceled, federal leasing for energy is canceled, and, you know, people are starting to drive more as, you know, the economy starts growing again. What does that do to inflation if the price of energy, which ripples through the economy, it's not just the price of the pump, but it ripples, you know, throughout the economy. What does that mean? And, you know, another thing that I guess this would almost be an anti-inflationary pressure, but I don't think most Americans, you know, think it's a good idea to undermine people that, you know, are working with a huge influx of new undocumented people crossing our southern border, which is, you know, that's already going up significantly. And as, you know, undocumented workers try to find work, that's going to depress wages, which that's going to be pretty upsetting to a lot of people, too.
Maybe, I don't know if you can answer this one or not, but it's one of those things that I've always wondered. The federal government, for all its size, is understaffed in many areas. If you've ever tried to get a passport, you know what I mean. It's 8 to 10 weeks for a passport. If you try to immigrate to this country, the process takes years because of the lack of staffing. Why is it we're so willing to write checks but not hire the people we need to, say, answer the phones at the IRS?
That's a really good question.
Well, I figured you'd just speculate. I mean, I really don't think you have an answer for it, but
I don't.
Okay, well, that's fair. Our guest is Jeb Bradley. He's a state senator, of course, and majority leader, by the way, of the New Hampshire Senate. Speaking of which, good news I hear for the budget biennium. Is it biennium? I think it is.
Yeah, biennium, yeah, okay. Every 2 years, but we have a budget every 2 years.
Back a couple of months ago, we were talking hundreds of millions of dollars possibly in a shortfall, and now I hear it's much less.
Yeah, it would appear that we're going to be in the $50 million range at the end of, you know, this fiscal year. I think that, you know, our economy, again, has done, you know, better than a lot of other states. I think that's a tribute to the governor's leadership. We've largely kept things open with precautions, obviously, in place. I mean, hasn't been perfect by any means. It's tough if you're in the hospitality industry, with or without the regulations. I think people are skeptical about, you know, going into public places for, you know, longer periods of time than, say, just the post office or the grocery store. So hospitality, you know, has obviously been really impacted. But for the most part, New Hampshire's open. The economy has been okay, given that we're in the middle of a pandemic. And our business tax revenues have been pretty strong. I mean, we're almost $80 million ahead through the end of January. Now, you have to balance that out, you know, that we were $115 million behind in, you know, fiscal 20, which ended in June. But, you know, given the loss of revenue in the prior fiscal year combined with, you know, the improving picture in this fiscal year, you know, the governor's estimate yesterday in his budget address of about $50 million is pretty remarkable.
It is. Pardon my ignorance, but where does that $50 million come from? Is there a rainy day fund? Is that borrowed?
So the governor is proposing to cap, I think it's $30 million out of the rainy day fund to help cover that, you know, deficit. And at the end of every year, money that doesn't get spent. And remember, there's been a hiring freeze until, you know, just today. I'm told that the governor has lifted the hiring freeze. So money that hasn't been spent by departments will lapse back into the general fund. So between those, you know, two things, we should be able to cover the, you know, budget deficit for fiscal 21. And with an expectation of revenue growth in, you know, the next fiscal year, which starts on July 1st. And look, I think we're getting vaccines into people's arms. It's been, you know, not everybody has gotten it as quickly as, you know, they want. And I would just say this for anybody listening that is having trouble. I've helped a number of people, you know, either work their way through the computer system or, if necessary, if they've been unable to go through the computer system or 211, the phone helpline to be able to, you know, get them appointments for their vaccine. So I would encourage people to call me up if they have an issue. My number is 387-2365. And, you know, I would try to do the best I can to get people vaccinated. More people are getting vaccines. The supply is increasing somewhat. That's good news. I was talking to people from the Hospital Association today. The number of people hospitalized is down back to about 130. That's good news. We don't see a Super Bowl party-related spike, which hopefully doesn't occur. Our percent of positive testing is going to come down, and then you combine that with, you know, the most at-risk people getting vaccinated by the end of March, largely, and then, you know, teachers and, you know, other workers in Group 2A, younger people. I think that by the summer, when we start, you know, in our typical tourist season, our rooms and meals revenue is going to go right through the roof because people are pent up. They want to get out. They want to do things. And New Hampshire is going to be a destination again. And so I anticipate, you know, strong revenues, business revenues, you know, improving. So I think that doesn't mean we don't have some issues that we have to deal with in the budget, mental health, substance abuse, you know, that kind of thing. But, I'm feeling, you know, given what we've gone through for the last year, that we're starting to turn a corner.
Well, that's important. I've always wondered, and I may have asked this question. I don't know if you have an answer. All of these vaccines and the testing and all of that, that's CARES Act money?
Yes.
Okay, because I don't know literally who's paying.
I mean, that was a
this.
Question that came up in hearings that we had earlier this week about, you know, if employers require a COVID test for somebody, for instance, to come back to work. And there may be a few people that have paid for their own COVID test as the result of an insurance billing error. But, as long as the state of emergency is on, it's my understanding COVID tests and the two I've had at Huggins, you know, no charge.
Yeah, I had one that was no charge, and the other they charged me because it was the rapid test, and I guess they were claiming that one was wasn't covered under the government mandate. I don't know. I paid it because I needed to know at the time. So it is what it is. But thank you very much for listening today. It's 12:20, and Jeb Bradley, state senator, is our guest today. As we talk about what's going on in Concord and other places, 569-5253. If you have a question or a comment, we'd love to get that from you, 569-LAKE. All right, Senator, so the other thing I want to talk to you a little bit about is the rooms and meals tax. I've heard there's actually going to be a slight drop. Should we, is this the time to be doing this right now, or is this just something to make people try to feel better? Because what is it,
so,
9 to 8.5?
I think, you know, if you go out to dinner with your family and, you know, you have a $100 bill for a meal, for instance, and your tax, instead of being $9, is $8.50, I don't think that's going to make a big difference whether people go out to eat or not.
Right, that was my thought.
However, I think that where we are not competitive in the rooms and meals taxes on larger functions, on weddings, on business conferences, things like that, where larger groups of people, and obviously that hasn't happened as much during the pandemic, but eventually the pandemic's going to be over. And the states around us have a lower rooms and meals tax So I think the governor is, you know, trying through this 0.5% proposed decrease in the rooms and meals tax to, you know, address that competitive imbalance with other states. So, you know, what we're going to have to do is weigh all of these things. You know, he's also proposed, you know, reducing the interest and dividends tax. And he's also proposed reducing the business enterprise tax. I think of the three, reducing the business enterprise tax is the most important. Small businesses have been the most under the most pressure, if you will, through the pandemic. And you know, large businesses have been much better able to stay open. Small businesses have had, you know, much greater struggles. And so small businesses generally pay the business enterprise tax. It's sort of large businesses, but it affects the small business further. The business enterprise tax is basically a payroll tax that is paid by the employer on the wages of the employee. And just for the record, when that went into effect, I think in 1993 or 1994, when I was in the New Hampshire House, I voted against it because I thought it was an income tax. Be that as it may, it's part of the landscape in New Hampshire today. And I fought to lower it from, you know, the rate that it was at, which was 0.675%. And we've gradually reduced it. It's 0.6% now. So I think, you know, this is the one, to me, of the three, is the most important.
There are some states that have sales tax holidays. Of course, we have no sales tax. But has anybody considered, like, a rooms and meals holiday for a weekend?
I think it's been considered. There was some discussion about it early on in the pandemic. But then, obviously, you know, as the pandemic took hold,
right,
and there were restrictions on, you know, the hospitality industry, there was, you know, that the discussion about a rooms and meals holiday sort of stopped happening. But, you know, it might be an interesting idea. Would that drive people to, you know, come up and spend the weekend in New Hampshire that otherwise might not? I don't know the answer to that.
Just off the top of my head, I don't think it'll inspire people, but it may have. If they say, hey, we can save, you know, 9% on our restaurant bill, they may have a meal where ordinarily, you know, in other words, they may have gone home for it.
I think that, you know, if you're looking to come to New Hampshire for a three-day weekend and stay in a hotel for a couple of those days, or, you know, a VBRO, Airbnb-type situation, which are taxable, you know, a tax holiday could be a pretty significant incentive if, you know, you're cutting 9% off the top.
Mm-hmm. But it doesn't seem to have a lot of fan club behind it from what I'm hearing.
Well, I think the governor has gone in the direction of let's lower it across the board. So we'll see what happens. You know, the Senate is in a somewhat admirable position. The House gets the budget right now. They have it based on, you know, the revenue estimates through, you know, January, and they're going to have to make some decisions and, you know, vote it out of the House in late March and early April. And we don't have to vote it out of the Senate until almost June. So a lot could change by then, in particular, you know, what might happen in Washington in terms of, you know, federal stimulus. And I think, you know, the governor's perspective on that, and I think people like myself and Senator Moore share this, that, you know, if we get a big chunk of federal money, that we should use it on one-time expenditure. So propping up the unemployment fund, that would be great because who knows when the next downturn will be, and it would ameliorate against an increase in the rates of the unemployment tax. Paying down some of our pension liabilities would be something that would make a lot of sense. Speeding up road and bridge water infrastructure projects, you know, would make a lot of sense. And I have one that I hope, you know, will pass the Senate in early March, my broadband matching grants initiative that, you know, would be, we'd be able to put some money into that right away to help cable and phone providers bring more wires to, you know, people's homes and the more rural, underpopulated areas, not just in the northern three counties, but throughout New Hampshire. You know, things like that, that if there is a stimulus package that, you know, gives states money that can be spent on purposes outside of, you know, COVID-related expenses, which the CARES Act up until now have dedicated it to, you know, COVID-related expenses, if it was unencumbered, those would be the kind of one-time expenditures I think that would make sense, as opposed to using it to grow, you know, the bureaucracy. That's not something that, you know, I think folks on my side of the aisle in the Senate are going to look too kindly on.
Well, I understand that. It's Jeb Bradley on WASR. Thank you very much for listening on a very, well, for February, nice Friday afternoon. Okay, Senator, thank you very much for being with us today again. Tell me about the broadband bill. There's one thing, and I don't know if I asked you or not about this. Most of the focus seems to be on wired broadband. I'm hearing rumors that there are, between the new 5G stuff and other companies looking to do what they call wireless internet, which is, to me, the simple explanation is Wi-Fi on steroids. Would that be included as a broadband provider?
No. The purpose of you know, my bill is to get wires into rural areas. I think that, you know, broadband wireless internet is coming, but I don't see it coming in a fashion, you know, that is, it's going to do what people need it to do with the gigabyte of speed to download and upload documents, that when people are working from home or telemedicine or multiple people multitasking at home or in their businesses, I think that's a ways out. And so I think that, you know, this is a good way to make sure that everybody has access, you know, to the extent practical, to the internet.
Okay.
At a speed that mirrors what we're trying to do on the internet.
Right. In fact, I just saw a commercial for satellite internet yesterday. So I went to their website and I looked it up, and it's slow and expensive, and there's also some pretty heavy data caps.
So there you go. I think eventually the technology is going to be there, but I think it's going to be a while.
It looks like you're right, because right now I think it's 25 megabits down. I don't know the upload speed, but there are very, very tight caps, unlike anything that, you know, we're used to in cellular or in home internet. But hopefully that will go. What is the position of that bill right now?
So, you know, I introduced it. It had a hearing maybe 3 weeks ago. I've worked with groups like Carroll County Broadband, Matt Flatch, who's a county commissioner, and he's been very active on Carroll County Broadband, and Rick Highland, run it by them for, you know, thoughts, and they had some suggestions. I worked with folks at the Municipal Association, also providers. So we've come up with an amendment that I think, you know, touches all the things that need to be touched. The one thing that's not in it is an appropriation. So my hope is the Senate will pass it in its phase without an appropriation, and then we'll hold it to include it in the budget, and hopefully we'll have either federal funds or potentially even some state general funds, to be able to really get started with it, much in the way that for a number of years we've had state matching grants for water infrastructure projects. Another bill that I have that had a hearing this week, that we've done that for a long time, a 20% grant, and it was suspended when John Lynch was governor during the last downturn, and really only in the last 3 or 4 years, because people like me have pushed for the state to keep its commitment that it made, we've funded these water infrastructure projects. Again, that's something that if we have unencumbered federal dollars, there's a lot of, need to upgrade our water systems. Obviously, road and bridges has been an ongoing issue for some time. Putting money into these types of, one-time expenditures, I think makes an awful lot of sense.
Can you explain to us, in simple English, how a bill and its appropriations are separate things? Because that's what I heard. If I'm wrong, please correct me.
So I filed the bill without an appropriation. Normally, you would file a bill with an appropriation. But I wanted to at least get the language on the grant matching grant piece done correctly. When you have a bill in either the House or the Senate, it generally goes first to a committee that deals with the policy implications, okay? That's where it's at now. Then if you had an appropriation in it, it would go to the Finance Committee. What I decided to do this time, rather than, put an appropriation on it, was to get it through the first stop, to get it to, the Senate Finance Committee, which will hold it, and then when we have the budget in May, depending on, what we have for resources to be able to fund it, and with the hope that there'll be some, a large amount of federal dollars that will be available for unencumbered purposes. So, that's, I think, the best way to proceed with, let's face it, this is a new program.
So in one sentence, the bill passes and then gets held while you're looking for funds.
Well, we're looking to fund it, and right. It will be part of the budget. Hopefully it'll be part of the budget with an appropriation, hopefully of several million dollars, that, will be folded into the Senate version of the budget.
While we're on the subject of budgets, I wonder if you could speak a little bit about education. I saw an interesting commercial recently on television about a private online school that claims that you don't have to pay a tuition, which tells me that probably the originating district is paying for it. Are you familiar with these kind of things? I think VLAX was one of them, and there are others.
More and more people are going to online education for post-secondary. There's also a online charter school in New Hampshire, that would be for K through 12, or some portions of it. So, as traditional universities, as the cost has gone up and up and up, more and more people are looking either to, the New Hampshire Community College system, which offers, practical training, quite frankly, whether it's nursing or automotive repair or any number of things, designed to give people skills that they can translate into jobs, or online, because the cost is so much less than, a traditional university. And I think that's one of the innovative things that the governor's proposed in his budget is to combine the community college with a university system. And it's certainly my hope that, you know, some of the cost savings and innovative ideas and job training, things that the community college does, really get translated more into the university system. So I think it's a great idea proposed by the governor. We'll see how it unfolds, but you know, more and more people are looking for that kind of, you know, training, education through online services, and that's a trend that's going to grow. I think we have to recognize it, and I think our university system has to adapt to it.
Well, I know that SNHU does a whole lot of television advertising about their online degree programs. Mm-hmm. That is a state school?
It's not a state school.
It is not. Okay.
No, Southern New Hampshire University. So they've done a good job.
Yeah,
and they're
thriving. Okay, I just thought that was a state school, but it is 1238, and again, 569-5253, if you have a question, 569-5253. Now, we're talking about bills, your charter school bill. Did that pass with an appropriation, or is that separate?
So, my charter school bill was last year. It did not pass.
Oh, it didn't.
What ended up happening is once the legislature changed in November, the body of the legislature called the Fiscal Committee, which is five people on the Senate Finance Committee and five people on the House Finance Committee, the partisan makeup of it changed. And so the outlook toward charter schools changed, and we accepted the $46 million grant that the feds had offered. And that was one of the first things the new legislature did. And I think, you know, it just, I think we had talked about this a lot, Eric, was one of the most nonsensical things I had ever seen, that charter schools, which are widely accepted, they're public schools, they're in the public school system, but they're outside of the traditional public schools, and they're chartered by the State Board of Education, and they're meant to be more innovative, more focused, and, you know, they run on about half the cost on a per-student basis, and parents love them because, you know, it gives an option for kids that, you know, our public school systems do a really good job for most kids, but some kids need something different. And so, you know, Northeast Woodland was one of the schools caught up in the lack of funding, and they were able to open their doors, but without that grant, it was questionable as to whether they'd continue to be able to function financially. The Fiscal Committee, and I served on it. I'm a alternate sometimes. Accepted the grant in early December, and the council, Joe Kenny, you know, on it now, approved it, and you know, it's helped a lot of charter schools in New Hampshire.
Okay, we're talking with Jeb Bradley. You have a Zoom meeting, so we only have a few minutes left. Tell me a little bit about. I know this is really not your area of expertise, and we touched on it at the top of the show. Do you think this stimulus plan has a chance of making it through the House and the Senate? I mean, the Senate is, in essence, a tie.
Yeah, I mean, I think as long as it doesn't hold things in it like a $15 minimum wage or, you know, pieces of the Green New Deal or, you know, immigration policy or things that I'm sure that, you know, some of the more progressive members of the House and Senate in Washington want, if it just sticks to, you know, fiscal issues that are related to the pandemic and aid for state and local governments. I suspect that despite the very tight numbers in the House, which I believe is 222 to 213, there may be a couple of vacancies. So it's roughly that number. Or 50-50 with Vice President Harris breaking the tie in the Senate. I think they can probably pass it. They don't need 60 votes in the Senate because it's being done under the budget reconciliation process, which only requires 51 votes to pass. So I think most observers think it'll pass, but, you know, if Biden insists on a $15 minimum wage, I think people like Joe Manchin and Kristen Sinema from Arizona, Manchin from West Virginia, have said they're not on board. And I suspect that, you know, some Democrats in the House would not be on board. Not many, but, you know, they probably can only lose 4 or 5 unless they're picking up Republican support. So it depends. I think the more focused it is, the better chance it has of prevailing. But let's also not forget that, you know, Nancy Pelosi held up a stimulus until late December for political purposes, the second one. So any number of things can still happen.
All right. We are coming up on 1:15. I know you said you had a Zoom meeting, so I think we will end it here to make sure that you can prepare for your meeting. You know, I understand that you're a very busy guy, and we very much appreciate the time that you give to WASR.
Well, I appreciate it very much, Eric. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Senator. We will talk next Friday.
Okay. Take care.
You take care now.